We're talking weird attractions, hidden sights, and unusual encounters in Wisconsin. It's time for Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In Portage, say hi to Giant Farmer Bob with a sausage in one hand and cheese in the other, of course. Props to Sheboygan for the world's most artistic luge. I appreciate the view driving by the world's largest M in Platteville. That's for mining, of course. The list of roadside attractions is long and strong. You can add to it at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite unique or weird attraction? How did you stumble across it? And what made your experience with it so special? Call in. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Beth Gopper is editor of MidwestWeekends.com. She's been writing about vacation travel in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa for more than 25 years. Beth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
So before we dive into all these kitschy, fabulous attractions we can find around Wisconsin, why do you think we're so drawn to these spots?
Oh, we're drawn to them because we can't look away from them. You know, it's most fun when you're driving along and you don't even know that one is there. And then you see it and you think, what the heck is that? Often there's a story behind it, but sometimes people put them up just for fun.
How do you think a roadside attraction becomes a roadside attraction?
Well, in Wisconsin, usually because it's really big.
What are some of the biggest ones that come to mind?
Well, the biggest fish, for example, is in Hayward, and that was built by the FAST Corporation, which is right in Wisconsin, and that stands for Fiberglass Animal Shapes and Trademarks. So that's a commercial company, but they have that kind of Wisconsin passion for the larger than life, and very noticeable. So that was made by commission, but a lot of towns have mascots, you know, the loon in Mercer. The Hodog in Rhinelander is actually kind of small, but very noticeable.
Yeah, so fiberglass is very helpful for these roadside attractions.
Yes, the concrete disintegrates.
Well, let's talk a bit about the unique attractions in southwest Wisconsin we might find around there, starting in Vernon County. Can you tell us about the round barns we can find there?
Yeah, Vernon County is one of my favorite places in Wisconsin. My ancestors actually settled there near Chaseburg, which is now in the middle of an Amish community. So the Amish moved in. This is farmland that's not quite as fertile as some in Wisconsin, but it's good for dairy farms. And after the Civil War, a lot of freed slaves moved to Vernon County, and old photos show that they were very integrated into the society. And the son of one of these slaves was a college-educated man named Alga Shivers, and he built round barns. And he also spoke French and Czech. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. The brown barns are, you know, there aren't as many as there used to be, but the ones that remain are very beautiful.
Yeah, and are do they kind of dot the countryside, or how many are there around?
Oh, I haven't checked lately. I mean, sometimes you get bad news because, you know, when
once
they get
collapsed.
Old, they it's too expensive to rebuild them. I think there are a dozen in Vernon County. And I think there are some in New England. I mean, they're here and there. But this is an especially large concentration.
And you write that, for some reason, Wisconsin was a particularly fertile ground for self-taught artists who had big imaginations but no commercial aspirations at all. So what do you see in this quirky folk art around the state?
Well, I personally love it. I love it everywhere. I love it in Chicago. You can see some at the Intuit Museum. But I think it's particularly effective to see it where it was made. And Wisconsin is so lucky to have the Color Foundation being the steward of these sites. So what they do is they take them over and they renovate, or they stabilize these pieces, and then they turn them over to local stewards. And I've been reflecting, why Wisconsin? I don't know, except that most of them, most of the people lived in remote areas, so they didn't have access to the world at large, and they were very curious about it.
Yeah.
So they used what was around them. They had this passion, like you say. There was nothing commercial about it. And they built what intrigued them.
So there's like Prairie Moon Sculpture Garden in north of Fountain City is
one of
them.
My favorites.
Yeah?
Yes. Yeah.
What do you like about it?
Oh, I mean, well, for one thing, it's right along the road. Although not it is right off 35, but you can't really see it from 35.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I like the fence that Herman Rusch made. It's so fanciful. I mean, how do you even get this idea? It's gold, gold tips with kind of conical posts, and it's red and orange colors. And it, where does that come from? And then inside there are some dinosaurs from actually a Minnesota farmer. A lot of these guys were farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Hindu temple, and there's a bust of Herman Rusch himself. He used to run a museum of oddities, and then he decided to start making his own.
We're taking in Wisconsin's peculiar roadside attractions with Beth Gopper as our guide. She's editor of MidwestWeekends.com. What is your favorite unique or weird roadside attraction in Wisconsin? What about it rises above all the others? Do you have stories? I have a picture as just a little tot standing at the feet of the Paul Bunyan and Babe the Blue Ox statues in Bemidji, Minnesota. So do share yours. We're at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Dan now, joining us from Drummond. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Well, the one attraction that people should have to see is in Hayward, and that's the Big Muskie Museum. It's a tribute to all the trophy muskies that have been caught over the many, many years.
Beth, you briefly just talked about this museum. What do you like about it?
Well, I'm not a big fisher person. I like the muskie because it's so large. I mean, you can put 20 people into its jaw, and people like to have weddings there. Another place, yeah, also in caves, strangely enough. But the other thing you can see when you're in Hayward is the Moccasin Bar. And that's not along a roadside, but it's inside the bar. You have to go inside the bar. And the first time I went in, it was smoky, so I think I left pretty quickly. But it's a bunch of little taxidermied weasels and squirrels and chipmunks doing things like playing poker and drinking beer. So that's uniquely Wisconsin, too.
Oh, of course. I mean, that's just what you would expect walking in, right?
Of course.
We're talking about the kitschy roadside attractions that we know and love around Wisconsin, like Pinky the Pink Elephant, a behemoth fiberglass sculpture, an ideal selfie location. Beth Gopper knows all about these weird and wonderful attractions as editor of MidwestWeekends.com. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. Have you toured a number of Wisconsin's oddities on a trip? Where did you go and how did you map it out? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the odd and peculiar here on Wisconsin Weekend in just a minute on the Ideas Network. We love odd roadside things here in Wisconsin. It's Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. There's the world's largest penny in Woodruff and Dr. Evermore's salvage scrapyard in North Freedom, but so much more, not to forget the Sputnik crash site in Manitowoc. You can add yours to the roadside attraction list as we get ready for summer road trips. 800-642-1234. Have you toured a number of Wisconsin's oddities in a big trick you took. Where did you go, and how did you plot it all out? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Beth Gopper is editor of MidwestWeekends.com. She stays with us. So, Beth, there's also this Dr. Evermore's Forevertron in North Freedom. Can you tell us a bit about this? What is it?
Well, Tom Every was a salvager, and again, he just started making stuff. There's a similar one in Minnesota. Apparently, having a lot of cool scrap metal at your hand is a very inspiration-inspiring. He also helped Alex Jordan build House on the Rock.
Mm.
So there are some connections among these artists, but in general, they all work on their own. He's an older guy now, but people can still visit the park, and I'm pretty sure the Kohler Foundation will help out with that in the future years.
We have a little bit of him talking here, his backstory, and let's hear a bit of it.
Our dear doctor was kind of like a scholarly professor that thought that he could perpetuate himself back into the heavens on a magnetic lightning force beam inside a glass ball, inside a copper egg.
So is Tom Every talking about himself here? Is this the fictional doctor? What's going on?
Oh, there's a lot going on in the minds of these people. I don't really know, and sometimes they don't know. Probably a lot of people have heard of the Wisconsin Concrete Park.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
in Phillips.
That was a guy named Fred Smith, and he said, "Nobody knows why I made them, not even me." That's 203 figures of concrete fashioned around a mink wire.
Yeah, the curators move on. You don't need to know anything here. So, you know, House on the Rock in Spring Green is also on lots of people's list of unique places to visit.
Mm-hmm.
What is the story behind House on the Rock?
Supposedly, the story is that Alex Jordan's father went to go show some blueprints to Frank Lloyd Wright. Now, you probably heard Frank Lloyd Wright mm-hmm. was a little arrogant. So he was snubbed, of course, as you would imagine. And he went back to Spring Green, and his son said, "I'm going to put a Japanese house up on that bluff where Frank Lloyd Wright has to look at it every day." And then he started filling it with stuff. Now, that I don't know the reason for that, but that's a pretty odd space. I always say bring some aspirin when you're finished walking through it.
And you mentioned in Rhinelander, Hodag statue. Why should people drive on over to this?
Oh, just for fun, of course. That was a funny story. It was built on a hoax. So the Hodag was a myth that people would talk about in the logging camps at night. Probably the nights were pretty long, and that's Paul Bunyan, of course, came out of a logging camp in Maine, not Minnesota. But and so eventually there was a logger who thought, "Well, I'm going to carry this joke a little farther," and he actually made a Hodag, like a mummified dead Hodag body. And he was able to carry that hoax on for about a week, convincing people it was real. And then after he was found out, people didn't mind. They thought, "Well, this is kind of a cool story." So he became the mascot of Rhinelander.
Well, let's go way up in Wisconsin. What about in Sister Bay at the tip of Door Peninsula?
Well, that's funny because that also was based on a joke. So, you know, we have Al Johnson's Swedish restaurant, and Al Johnson had a friend who would give him a gag gift every year for his birthday. And in 1973, Al Johnson and his family had just put a new sod roof on their restaurant, and so his friend gave him a goat, off with a goat, and put him up there, and of course it became a tourist attraction.
I had no idea those goats have been up there so many years, so many decades.
Just one to start with, and then as in everything else in Wisconsin, more and more. I think there are only like three now or something, but now there's a goat parade, and you know, it's become the theme of Sister Bay.
Sure, it certainly snowballed like so many of these odd attractions.
Exactly.
Yeah, odd attractions do. Well, Beth, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Beth Gopper is editor of MidwestWeekends.com, and she's been writing about vacation travel in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa for more than two decades. Our WPR series called High Tolerance continues this morning as we look at Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. And the team from Wisconsin Life is bringing us two installments this morning. In the first, producer Maureen McCollum explores the Wisconsin cocktail.
When you think about a cocktail that embodies Wisconsin, what comes to mind?
Typically, you look for the old-fashioned.
The old-fashioned.
The old-fashioned, because that's like the quintessential Wisconsin cocktail.
Ah, yes, the old-fashioned. And in Wisconsin, that typically means a brandy old-fashioned sweet or sour.
And that's the Wisconsin one where you add soda to it, which most people, unusually brandy, with sometimes whiskey or bourbon.
That's John Dye, the owner of Brian's, an historic cocktail lounge in Milwaukee. He says the original old-fashioned is a simple cocktail with bitters, sugar, and a spirit.
When somebody comes from out of town and they order an old-fashioned, that's generally what they want. If they order somebody orders an old-fashioned without specifying sweet or sour, we have to ask them where they're from. And that's usually a way to get to the bottom of it.
Some say the recipe made its way to Wisconsin from New Orleans via the Mississippi River. But Wisconsinites really latched onto the cocktail after Korbel was introduced at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. Bryant's is known for another cocktail with Wisconsin roots. Its founder, Bryant Sharp, invented a few ice cream cocktails back in the 1930s for a liquor company.
I think the most famous one that people know is the Pink Squirrel. It's sort of a cream-based drink that has sort of an almond flavor to it, and it's a pink color.
Although you can find recipes for a Pink Squirrel in books and online, the folks at Bryant's will not divulge its secret recipe. Dye says it's a tradition that goes back to Sharp's time.
When he first started hiring people, he would actually wrap all the bottles in foil and everything was numbered, so not even the bartenders would know what they were pouring. So it's always been very secret. And we still keep a sort of secret nature of our recipes. We don't tell people our recipes, and we kind of keep them to ourselves and have for 80 years. And a lot of the recipes we use are Bryant's original recipes, which is a pretty neat thing.
But what other cocktails embody Wisconsin?
Well, you start with your pint glass, then you fill it with ice, and it gets two shots of vodka. And then we use our Bloody Mary mix is Zing Zing, and you top it off with a pickle, couple olives, mushroom.
Don't forget the beer chaser.
Wash down the tomato juice, I think, is why they do that.
Jessica Carnop is a bartender at Kroll's West in Green Bay. Its neighbor across the street, Lambeau Field. Needless to say, she and her coworkers mix a lot of Bloody Marys on football Sundays.
And we actually pre-make those for the game days because we get so many of them. Especially our noon games. We open up at 8 and people come in. Bloody Marys is one of our most popular drinks that they get.
But why are Bloody Marys so common for tailgating parties and for brunches across Wisconsin?
They taste so good.
All right, so we've talked about the old-fashioned, Pink Squirrel, and Bloody Mary, all classic common cocktails found across Wisconsin. But what about something different, something modern?
So we're going to go with a cocktail we call Breakfast with Petey Pablo.
Thor Messer is the beverage director for restaurant group Rule Number One, which includes Merchant in Madison. He says Breakfast with Petey Pablo is a non-traditional scotch cocktail with chai tea, whipped cream, and most importantly, coffee.
Wisconsin has done an amazing job with coffee over the last 10 years. You know, we were looking at local producers and farmers and things like that, and we're like, well, coffee is like a legit thing that we're doing on a big scale that's really great.
And what about Petey Pablo? You know, the rapper from the early 2000s?
It just tied in perfectly because scotch is traditionally peaty. So peat is essentially the smokiness or that earthiness that you get out of scotch whiskey. And Petey Pablo, it just kind of morphed into this, like, well, that's fun.
This story was part of WPR's project High Tolerance. It's a deep dive into Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. There, you can also find recipes for each of the cocktails featured in this story.
I'm old-fashioned, because I want an old-fashioned with plenty of brandy and cherry on top.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And it is Wisconsin Weekend here on The Morning Show. Coming up, we talk with a chemistry professor about whether Lake Superior's water does, in fact, make for tastier beer. Stay with us for a chemistry lesson in brewing after this news update right here on the Ideas Network. We are taking a whirlwind at chemistry of beer class here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Beer makers in Duluth Superior are very firm on this. The water from the cold depths of Lake Superior is the best for brewing beer. But then there's the malt and hops and that tricky, tricky yeast. Have you tried making beer in your basement, garage, or kitchen? How did it go? What lessons did you learn that you could share with others? We're at 800-642-1234. Aileen Beard is a chemistry professor at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, where she's taught a class about the chemistry of making beer. And she joins us from our studios in Superior this morning. Aileen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So when our show visited Superior last month, we heard that Lake Superior's water is ideal for brewing beer. Can you refresh our memory a little? What is going on with the water in Lake Superior?
Well, you know, the beauty of Lake Superior is that there's not a lot in the water. Beer is 95% water, so if there's a lot of things in the water to start with, you have to remove it to before you can start making beer. And so, we sort of describe it as a clean slate. It allows you to put in whatever you want into the water that'll affect the flavor of beer, and you don't have to remove it. So that's ultimately the reason. It's fairly soft. There's not a lot of calcium, magnesium, and that kind of stuff in it.
And that probably also makes it easier for brewers, less expensive, since you don't have to remove the minerals through filtration or reverse osmosis.
Absolutely.
So would brewers ever want to add those minerals back into the mix? Do calcium, sodium, or magnesium help you get certain flavors in the end?
They absolutely do. Being able to control the exact amounts makes it a little bit easier for quality control and those kinds of things. So yeah, absolutely. We typically add calcium, sometimes sodium, sometimes magnesium into the beer.
And what does that do to the beer's taste?
It does a few things. You know, in terms of chemistry, it lowers the pH, and so that can alter how you perceive some of the other flavors, so it makes it a little bit less acidic, so to speak. And the other thing that it does is it can kind of it's what we call, you know, make it fuller, sweeter, sometimes maybe a little bit more mellow. And some of these, you know, experiential kind of flavors, they're hard to describe until you kind of have to feel them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, after water, the 95% part, the three other ingredients are the malt and the hops and the yeast. So let's start with malt. What exactly is malt, and how can brewers use it to change the flavor they're trying to achieve?
Well, malt provides the basis for beer. It's what provides all of the sugars for the yeast to metabolize and make ethanol. Almost all beers use a malted grain of some sort. Malt simply means the grain has been germinated. Mm-hmm. So that gets the enzymes working that we want to convert starches into sugars that can then be converted into alcohol.
And then how it's roasted has an impact as well.
Absolutely. The darkness, it'll affect the color of your beer. It also affects the flavor. When you roast the malt, it goes through a caramelizing process similar to what you do when you make caramel from sugar. And so that changes the flavors that you're going to extract out of the malt.
We are getting a chemistry lesson involving beer with Aileen Beard. She is a chemistry professor at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, where she's taught a class about the chemistry of beer making. What questions do you have about making beer? What do you want to know about boiling hops and working with yeast or finding the best tasting water? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. So let's move on to the hops. There seems to be a lot of variety out there that brewers can use. Can you walk us through basically the landscape a little bit?
Oh, wow. there are so many different varieties of hops right now. The hops provide a couple of different things. They provide a lot of what most people would describe as flavor, not just taste. So what we can taste out of the hops is the bitterness parts of them, the isoalpha acids that produce some of the bitter flavors. But they also produce a lot of aromas, the things you associate with, like fruity tastes, fruity flavors, those kinds of things. Those are all aromas, and so depending upon when you add the hops, what kind of profile the hops have, will define what your beer tastes like.
So how can boiling your hops at different temperatures change the taste, the aroma, whatever you end up with there?
Well, I mean, when you boil, it's all going to be at the same temperature because boiling water is going to be at 100 degrees Celsius or 212 Fahrenheit. But it has more to do with how long you boil them.
Okay.
And when you put the hops in. If you put the hops in early, those are likely to drive off all of those low-boiling compounds that are going to produce a lot of your aromas. So what you're going to get left with is the bitterness parts of the hops, the bitterness chemicals. And so if you add hops later in the process, so they're only boiled for, say, 2 or 3 minutes, that will pull out a lot of those low-boiling, aroma-causing compounds that will really add a lot more flavor to your beer.
And then there is a yeast, which has a personality all of its own. Some brewers grow their own cultures and use the same strains over and over again. Can you help us get a handle on this yeast process?
it's a pretty complex, ultimately, what these little molecules do in metabolizing to produce ethanol. Yeast are similar to, we use generally one major type of yeast in brewing beer, but yeast is kind of like people. So there's a lot of different varieties, even though we're all human. we have very different qualities, and yeast is that way as well. And so in addition to producing ethanol, they also produce a lot of other byproducts, and those affect the flavor of the beer. Some yeasts are really identifiable. In Belgium, the yeast produce a lot of different types of esters and kind of fruity flavors to them that you can identify it almost immediately. Other yeasts are a little bit less identifiable, but if you want quality control and you want to produce the same beer every time, which most people do if they're going to sell the beer, then you've got to use the same ingredients, and that means the yeast cells have to be the same.
And that must be really difficult to replicate. How important is keeping out bacteria or yeast that actually exists in the air naturally?
Well, again, if you want quality control, you want the same flavors all the time. So you don't want other yeast from the air, from contamination from another source, because that'll produce different flavors. A lot of our wild yeast will produce some sour flavors. That's actually how we make sour beers. But if you don't want a sour beer, you don't want that contamination. It usually badly affect your beer. Bacteria is the same way. It's the bacteria that's in beer that may end up in your beer is not going to kill you. It's not going to it's not toxic. Alcohol will kill those kinds of bacteria, but they can produce flavors that aren't necessarily good.
So as a chemist, what's the most interesting part of the brewing process to you? What really speaks to you?
I love the whole process. I mean, it's about taking it start to finish. It's about, adjusting every step to control the process, because if you change things just a little bit, if you go through the mashing process at a little bit different temperature, if you ferment your beer at a little bit different temperature, you get different beers, different tastes.
But is there creativity in the process? Do you see some room to experiment and be creative?
Yeah, and that's exactly why I like that. So as you control that, then you change it. You see what happens with the flavor. If it's a good thing, you do it again. If it's not a good thing, you don't do it again. I consider making beer really an art as much as it is a science. And I think most brewers would agree with that.
We are looking at the chemistry of brewing beer, and we have Aileen Beard as our trusted guide. She's a chemistry professor at the College of St. Scholastica, and she's taught a course on beer making there for a long time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you visited a brewery here in Wisconsin and learned about making beer? What about the process stuck with you? Would you recommend the experience to others? You can call in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to our chemistry lesson on beer in just a moment. It's Wisconsin Weekend on the Ideas Network. We're learning about the chemistry of brewing on this edition of Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So get this, at the College of St. Scholastica, each student in chemistry professor Aileen Beard's class on beer making has had to taste test a sip of sun-skunked warm beer before they talked about exactly what went chemically wrong. And our eyes might glaze over, not from the beer, when trying to understand those alpha acids and what went wrong. Nevertheless, are you an amateur brewer or interested in becoming one? What questions do you have about getting started? Join in at 800-642-1234. And Aileen Beard stays with us. What is it like teaching college students about the chemistry of beer making?
Oh, it's a lot of fun, actually. It's fun to have students, excited about learning chemistry. Giving them a topic that speaks to them, so to speak.
Oh, yeah, it's accessible, huh?
That's right. My favorite description or comment from a student was that this course has ruined beer drinking for me. I took that as a pretty cool comment, because what they meant by that was instead of just drinking to drink, they started drinking and evaluating as they were drinking a beer. So they were drinking slower. They were stopping to kind of think about what they were experiencing instead of just trying to see how much they could drink. And from a college, you know, when you teach at a college, that's a pretty important factor.
Yeah, and the students produce their own beer in the class. Is that right?
They do. Every student actually leaves with a 12-pack of beer.
And they're 21 when they enter this class.
Correct. We do taste testing, so they have to be.
Fred from Oconomowoc called in to ask, what do you know about dry hopping? How does that affect the flavors?
You know, dry hopping is going to what happens is you extract some of the acids from the beer, but they do not get converted into the iso-alpha acids, which makes often a little bit more bitterness to the beer. You know, the alcohol, once there's alcohol in there, it's going to extract a little bit more of those chemicals. But they're going to be sort of in their unchanged state, so to speak. And so it affects it a little bit differently. You do get a lot more bitterness. You also will get some of the more volatile compounds, the low boiling compounds, essential oils that help bring in the aromas into the beer.
When people make bad tasting beers, where do they get tripped up in the process?
Almost always, it's in how clean they are, how careful they are about sterilizing their equipment.
Huh, and that's just a basic lab 101 thing.
Absolutely.
I know when we were at Superior, the Earthrider Brewery in Superior last month, the equipment seemed to be all stainless steel, and it was so clean in there. There wasn't a speck of dust. Is there something to that?
I mean, stainless is a standard equipment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that critical that it has to be stainless, but it can't be something that might react with the chemicals in the beer. And so stainless happens to be easy to clean, so that makes life a little bit easier, and it's fairly unreactive. So you wouldn't want to take an aluminum pan, for example. Because that'll oxidize as in the process and bring in some of the aluminum metal ions into your beer, which you probably wouldn't want. But certainly the cleanliness, it matters. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is that some beers, some of the sour beers in Belgium, actually take pride in not being clean.
Well, Aileen, this has been so much fun. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Aileen Beard is a professor of chemistry at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth, where she's taught a class about the chemistry of making beer, and she joined us from our Superior studios this morning. Let's pick up now with our WPR series on alcohol called High Tolerance. Here's Wisconsin Life producer Maureen McCollum with a profile of a craft brewer in our state and the international organization that helps her get a toehold in the industry.
Amanda is a brewer at Wanakee's Octopi Brewing. While she's a young, tenacious woman, she describes her brewing and drinking style as being very much the opposite.
I kind of tell people that my brewing style is very much like a 40-year-old man who just discovered craft beer in the 90s. And when I say that to brewers, they kind of understand where I'm coming from. I like old school hops. I like a malty backbone. I like clarity.
WPR's Jenny Peake visited Deanda at Octopi Brewing to learn more about how she got into the craft and what it's like to be a female in a male-dominated industry.
The world of craft beer opened up for Erica Deanda 4 years ago during a tasting class at a high-end brew pub in Oakland, California. A recent hire, the owners had Deanda and her coworkers taste a variety of brews so they could aptly describe them to their customers.
I knew nothing about beer at that point except for I did not like it at all. You know, it was disgusting, give me a pink drink. I don't want beer. One of our first like training days, they had us trying some, you know, like really fancy bottles, and I remember trying a beer, and I just remember it had like this oaky kind of tart. It almost reminded me of like a Chardonnay, and I just was in awe that this was beer. It wasn't bitter, it wasn't harsh, it was kind of like sweet, and just had all these different characteristics, and I'm like, I need to know more.
After 4 years of completely immersing herself in the world of brewing, Deanda, now 28, is a brewer at Octopi Brewing in Wanakee and the chapter president of Wisconsin's Pink Boot Society, an international nonprofit that supports women working in the brewing profession. While it was a quiet day at Octopi when I went to meet Deanda, she had a lot to say about how being a part of the society has helped her make connections and get inspiration along the way.
It's important to feel like you're connected to people who kind of are, you know, similar to you. And I think for me, it's also been a big inspiration to meet other women who work in this industry, and not only work, but are dominating this industry, especially when it's, you know, kind of a boys' club, so to speak. For me, it's always been the inspiration. I got into brewing. I was really confused as to where I was going with my life. When I found the Pink Boot Society, it was very much like I was working in a tap room. I went to my first collaboration brew day where I met a couple of women brewers out in California. And just seeing what they were accomplishing and seeing how dedicated they were to their job, it was like, I want to do that and I can do that.
Beyond creating a platform for women in the beer industry, Deanda says the Pink Boot Society and the rise in women brewers is transforming beer culture.
I also think with the Me Too movement, sexual harassment in the brew house is kind of becoming like a big prominent issue. I've been reading a lot of stories about brewers who have harassed bartenders and things like that. And like I said, the guys who I work with are all supportive. And so I think that, you know, we can all kind of come together and be a driving force. But I think women can be a powerhouse to kind of knock some of these things that have been disregarded for so long. There's a misconception that we're like all these like feminists and we don't want boys in the club and things like that. We do. We want allies. We want people supporting us. We're just trying to encourage other people and to push anybody into the beer industry and advance women's careers as much as we possibly can.
For up-and-coming women brewers, Deanda says to never stop trying.
I always like to say, when someone shuts a door in your face, just go through the window. Don't let anybody tell you no, you can't do it. Also, don't stand in your own way. It just takes a lot of hard work and dedication. This isn't something that just happens overnight. But if you really dedicate your time to it, you can be a force to be reckoned with in the beer industry, I think.
Why can't women have a good beer drinking song?
That story came to us from WPR's Jenny Peek. It's part of WPR's project High Tolerance, a deep dive into Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. To hear all the stories, go to WPR.org/alcohol. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And if you have an idea for Wisconsin Weekend that could reach all corners of our state, send us an email to mornings@WPR.org and we'll explore your idea for an upcoming Wisconsin Weekend. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.